Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Great to have you with me. I'm Aaron Noonan. This is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. For another week, I've been off and about in recent times on a road trip through Queensland, chatting to a bunch of guests. Now, my next guest is going to be a two-parter because we talked about so much stuff. Part one this week, part two next week. Roland Dane, the longtime head of Triple Eight Race Engineering, accepted the invitation. I came around with the microphone, sat down on his back deck in Brisbane, and we talked about a whole pile of stuff. So in part one, this part, we cover a whole pile of really interesting stuff. We talk about the new era of Triple Eight Race Engineering, how it's situated, who's on the board, how does it all work, who, what, when, where, why, and how. And then we rewind back to his early years in business and motorsport in the UK. We talk about the massive British Touring Car Championship, of course. Triple Eight were the factory Vauxhall team in the latter part of the Super Touring era, and then moving into the era where the cars were, well, downgraded in their spec to control the costs and keep the championship flowing. We talk about, of course, coming to Australia, not just establishing Triple Eight in V8 supercars, but before that, about Roland's first trips to Bathurst for those 2-litre AMP Bathurst 1000s for super tourers in 97 and 1998. In fact, he talks about how he was actually quite underwhelmed by the whole experience of coming to Bathurst that first time. If you remember, we're in the middle of a split between the traditional Bathurst race and the broadcaster, V8 Supercars, Channel 10 of Esco, Super Touring, Toka, ARDC, you name it, every acronym involved was among it all. So it's an interesting comment and some interesting discussions we have about his first experiences at the place that has really defined Triple Eight moving forward. And of course, we end this first part into the V8 Supercar era, talking about how Craig Lowndes came to join Triple Eight Race Engineering in a deal done late in 2004. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. This is part one of Roland Dane on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. Roland Dane, thank you for having me at your place. We're looking at a lovely Brisbane day, blue sky. I don't know what that is, living in Melbourne. Thank you for hosting. Great to see you.
You're very, very welcome.
A lot of topics to cover off here, but let's start sort of now. We're about 6 months into the year. You're no longer full-time triple eighting as we've seen you for so many years. Mm. Are you enjoying it? You feel relaxed? Do you have you had some time to do some other stuff you've been wanting to do for a while?
Yes, I think after you've been working since you're 18 and working for myself essentially since mid-80s, that's a long time. Mm. And it's been very good to stand back a little bit. I had a 3 weeks or so in Europe recently, and it was the first holiday I've been on for as long as I can remember where I was utterly relaxed, because these days I've got two employees, and for years and years I've had anywhere between 50 and 300 people that I'm responsible for. So it really enabled me to kick back and enjoy some real time off. So far, so good. I'm not saying that I'll be that relaxed forever.
So we haven't got rid of you forever. There might be something that tempts you enough to go, well, I've got a bit more time up my sleeve to put to this.
Well, I mean, there's more to life than motor racing, Noons, as you
true.
Should know.
True.
But the in terms of, you know, day to day at the moment, I mean, I'm still chairman of 888. I still chair the board meetings. I'm still at the end of an email when Jamie or Jess asks me questions, etc. But I don't get involved in the day to day side of it, and I'm still on the board of PWR, which is not only in motor racing, but in motor racing is one of the real success stories of Australia over the last 2 decades, and then I sit on the FIA Touring Car Commission and the Motorsport Australia Safety and Risk Committee. So, yeah, it's a bit going on to keep me sort of in touch with what's going on.
For those who don't know of our listenership, we talk about boards and teams, and who is on the 888 board for those who might not know?
Yeah, the 888 board consists of myself as chairman, Jamie and Jessica as executive directors, in other words, people who work there. Tony Quinn as a non-executive director, and his right-hand man, Rex Devantier. So also Tim Miles sits in on some of the board meetings as an observer when he has time. And he's got a wealth of knowledge. And as many people know, we're very good friends, but he also knows Quinny very well. He was a shareholder in 888 for a long time and a director. So he from time to time is also involved. But essentially the board is myself, Jamie, Jessica, Tony and Rex.
Hmm. The Touring Car Commission, what does that involve? Because I guess a lot of our Aussie listeners, we're kind of this island, literally, in not just physicality but in our motorsport, our touring car, supercar. What does that involve? How does it affect our championship? What's the link there?
Well, the FIA is the world governing body of motorsport, and under that, Motorsport Australia sits as the local ASN in this neck of the woods. The FIA has a number of commissions and working groups, etc., the most important of which is the World Council, which governs the way the FIA operates, etc., of which, of course, one of the leading lights on that is Gary Connolly, who's Brisbane-based, but is also the leading Formula One steward in the world. So there are Australians then sit on a number of the commissions, which are basically committees, underneath the World Council, and one of them is the Touring Car Commission. Currently, most of its mandate at the moment is around the World Touring Car Championship, but it is expanding that gradually to really include aspects of sustainability and across all touring car motorsport across the world. But it's a good forum and gives you an introduction to people who may have other ideas about how to do things, particularly when it comes to looking at things like the long-term viability of motorsport in a changing world. So to me, it's important to sort of keep in touch with those trends, even though we're not really involved in the World Touring Car Championship itself, but there are a number of spin-off things that are always good to hear and keep on top of.
Mm. You talked about working for so many years. So when you're 18, where are we? When are we? Is this the Panther, which was what it started for you in terms of cars and work and that side of things, and you've been full stick ever since?
Yeah, no, I have, and it's and I can understand now. I didn't always, but I understand now why people. Yeah, when you get to 65, there's a tendency to step back a little bit.
Did you have that built in your brain, the number of when you were going to go to, or just worked out that way?
But for different reasons. I'd always, one of the things I don't like is seat blockers. So in motor racing, we call drivers who hang around too long seat blockers, and they can appear in all sorts of sports, but it's also in business as well. And I think that I'd always seen 65 as being an age where nothing to do with whether I was tired or fed up or bored or whatever, but just to do with having proper succession planning in place, that I should have a plan for getting to that age and being able to give the at least the day-to-day reins of running the business in Australia as well as elsewhere to somebody else. And so it wasn't an accident that it sort of panned out the way it did and came to a head with Jamie taking over at the end of last year.
I mentioned before about the pan thing. So that took me way back in. So we're in the 70s here with your first sort of real proper job. But was there car flavour in your life as a young bloke, or did it just – because it's funny that a lot of people – in motorsport and cars get it from their parents or there's a family involvement. But then there's some people who have no connection and they find it themselves and it becomes their thing. But what was it for you?
Yeah, the car and motorcycle thing really was me. You know, my father was he was an SAS officer in the war. He was then a doctor, a virologist, very famous one. And he liked motorized things. He had Land Rovers when a Range Rover first came out. He had one of those, etc. And enjoyed that sort of thing. But he could take it or leave it as well. Whereas I was pretty fanatical about them, and I had a Morris 1000 when I was 12. My parents had just moved to England from Ireland. They had plenty of land, and I was able to have a car on there and bugger around, paddock bashing, as it were, the equivalent, such as you can in a country with as many people as the UK. But anyway, and I had motorcycles, albeit small ones, that I was allowed to have, at home. And I built my first hovercraft when I was 16 as well.
Hovercraft?
Yeah, and that led to hovercraft racing and bike racing. So but it all came from me, really. I was just interested in burning up fossil fuel.
Carried on ever since.
Yeah,
but there's even before all of this, you've got Australian ancestry connection. A lot of people go, "Oh, bloody invaders, come here and stole a pile of trophies and all that stuff." But there's a bit of Australian connection long before you came here to run Triple Eight.
Yeah, well, bearing in mind that the vast majority of us are immigrants at some stage or another into this country. But my paternal grandfather was born in Australia, born in Adelaide in 1892. And his father came to Adelaide as any person from South Australia will tell you, as a free settler. It always makes me laugh. And he became the first postmaster in Mount Gambier when they built a post office there in 1860 something. So the connections there, my parents met in Adelaide after World War II in the early 50s, and then went back to Ireland. And so my godfather was a GP in Adelaide, and he used to send me Wheels magazine every month for years, which made me have an awareness of stuff that was going on in Australia, which normally you just wouldn't be aware of in the normal course of events. No internet or anything in the UK, and I'd look with just fascination at the cars that were made here, and also some of the cars that were originally from the UK that were then made in a different form. Different forms of Austin 1100s or Minis or whatever that were made here. And I was fascinated by it all, let alone the motor racing stories in there as well.
Where did the wheeler and dealer gene? Because if you're involved in selling cars, there's a wheeler and dealer gene somewhere that's been passed on. Where does that come from?
Yeah, the grandfather who was born in Australia, he went off to fight in World War One and then didn't come back to Australia afterwards. Stayed in the UK, and he became the owner of a newspaper in the UK, which got merged with another one in the 1960s. But he was chairman of a big printing press there called Odams. He was probably wrong to call him a wheeler dealer, but he was very commercially focused, a massive philanthropist, and wing of the Great Ormond Street Hospital, in Children's Hospital in London, had his name on it for many years. So he was very commercial, and so probably came from there, because I can't see where else it came from.
Hone in. That sounds about right to me. That does click together. So Panther, a little car company in the UK. That's kind of we've got the automotive flavour going. Don't really know what you want to do, where you want to go. Don't have this grand plan, but that's the first kind of step on what leads you here. And what were you doing? What was it? I mean, there's a lot of people in Australia that would have never heard of what a Panther was.
Yeah, so Panther Westwinds, as a company was called in the 1970s, was the brainchild of a guy called Robert Jenkel, who worked in the clothing industry, fashion industry. And he loved cars, and he built a car in his spare time and everything. And everyone said, well, why don't you start making it, et cetera. So in a way which was sort of easier back then, I suppose, that fewer regulations, and there was no type approval as such when he started in the early 70s.
Yeah, just go for it.
Pretty much, as long as it had lights and mirrors on it. So he started off making a modern version of a Jaguar SS 100. And it was a very nicely built vehicle, beautifully built, using different craftsmen around the south of England to do body work, to do trim work, etc., paint work. He brought them all together under this umbrella of Panther Westwinds, and it wasn't big. We're talking about 50, 60 people in the mid-70s. And I was there having, not really had a good run through school from an academic point of view.
Because you didn't like it, or you were no good?
I just got bored with it, to be honest, and only paid attention to things I wanted to pay attention to. And so, and everyone in my family, if they haven't been to university once, it's because they've been twice. and I was the outlier. So I had to get a job, otherwise, I'd failed miserably and everything. And I wrote to two companies in the UK first off to see if somebody would just give me a job as a learner.
As just anything, whatever, wherever.
Gopher. Yep. And one was a company called Rickman, which made motorcycle frames at the time. Highly thought of, and the other was Panther. And the guy who owned Panther rang the house and said, if you want to come for an interview tomorrow, come up. So I went up, and he gave me a job, which was basically as an apprentice, as a management apprentice, if you like, where I had to work for between 3 and 6 months in each department of the company, both making stuff and also administratively, and see how I came out of that.
I see some links to what happened later on down the line at 888 too with that.
Yeah. So I got stuck into that. I loved it. Had a good time. But essentially learned an awful lot about how not to do shit. because Panther, while it was an interesting company to work with, in hindsight, it was extraordinarily badly run. And the concept of cash flow was severely misunderstood. So, and the finance director, who was a lovely bloke, but he was more interested in cricket and that shitty British beer that, you know, is flat as a pancake and everything and warm, and he'd always keep a barrel of it in his office. So exactly. So I learned an awful lot about how not to do stuff as well as how to do stuff. And that has proved really important, I think, as my life's gone on. So, the company went through a receivership, but was bought out by a Korean business called Jindo. This all happened through the sort of second oil crisis, as it was in Europe in 1980, 79-80. Bought by Jindo, and I ended up a couple of years later running the business for them. Too young, really, but because I was 25 or 26 or something at the time. But it taught me a lot very quickly. It also taught me that I didn't really like the Korean mentality of how they interacted at that time with people. It's pretty harsh, to say the least, but probably a good learning experience for me, and then convinced me that I had to work for myself.
Mm. Park Lane is the next thing that probably sticks in my mind. So if you're an Australian race fan, you probably heard of it, because we got the British Touring Car Championship.
Right.
The two-litre era, Wide World of Sports. We had our own series here. So that's probably where the Park Lane name pops up for us in Australia, but it had been going for a while before that. So in essence, it was buying and selling cars and dealing with people here, there and everywhere. It wasn't just UK, was it? It really grew.
Yeah, I mean, I spotted a few opportunities when I was still working at Panther, etc. I formed Park Lane in 1986, and essentially to buy and sell cars on new cars for the most part, but not wholly, in between the right-hand drive markets in Asia and the UK. So that means Japan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, not Australia, because Australia had introduced Australian design rules, which started to make it very hard to trade cars in Australia, but also it included New Zealand. So trading cars backwards and forwards, and in those days it meant a lot of travel. So for years and years I was every month traveling backwards and forwards from Asia in a big way. It also exposed me to a lot of things and taught me a lot. And one thing that we'd been involved in at Panther was in the specialized vehicle areas and armored cars, stretch limousines, etc. And I managed to get the franchise from a German coach building company based in Bremen in North Germany that made armored Mercedes and stretched Mercedes and sometimes armored and stretched. and I got the franchise to represent them in the Middle East and the Far East. And so that became a big part of what I was doing, selling in through that sort of corridor from on the Western Pacific from Japan southwards.
Why Park Lane? Why was it called Park Lane?
Purely because the primary market in those days that I went after to begin with was Japan, and I needed something that resonated as being British-based. My office was in Park Street, which is actually behind Park Lane, which runs parallel. But Park Street doesn't sound as good as Park Lane.
No, it sounds a bit more impressive, yeah.
And the logo was above the name Park Lane was a picture of Marble Arch. So you're just trying to make yourself sound better than you were.
Hey, why not? Why not? Yeah. It's all about what it looks like and what it feels like. Sometimes not so much about what it is like. It might be where it's getting to. So where does because a lot of our listeners know you as Roland Team Principal, 888 guy, but they don't know you as competitor. Or they might have seen you have a bit of a burn in more recent times with your, the stuff up in Townsville that you've done and a bit of Hyundais and this and that. But you raced like, was it Honda CRXs and all sorts of bits and pieces back in the late 80s, I guess it was.
On and off from late 70s through to mid 90s, I was racing on and off myself, depending on how busy I was. And in the earlier days, definitely depending on how much money I had. I look back with rose-tinted spectacles for sure. But I had a 1980, I reckon, I had a yellow 1.5 Ti Alpha Sud two-door with a roof rack on it with a hovercraft and a trailer with a RD400 Yamaha motorcycle so that I could try and encompass motorcycles and hovercrafts in one weekend. Because the most race meetings, I can promise you, were only one day back then. So had a lot of fun, but then I started, I've started with Ford Fiestas as a one make championship. Then started racing CRXs, Honda CRXs.
I've seen some vision.
Yeah, it was very well supported by Honda UK and a very good championship. And I did some other stuff, the odd race in, Renault Clios. And I did several years, 3 or 4 years of Group N as well with Honda Civic, which I enjoyed. Enjoyed those cars a lot. When I was at Silverstone for the Friday of the British Grand Prix a few weeks ago, and I ran into the guy who used to beat everyone in those one-make races back in the day, a guy called Dave Loudon, who literally could almost earn a living out of the prizes he got from being so successful in one-make racing. And he was the king of them. He was absolutely the king of one-make racing and so extraordinarily talented at that level, never made it any further and never really looked as though he did want to. But the one-make racing level was so high back in those days. And it was, and that's why I'm such a big supporter of the Toyota 86 thing here in Australia, because I think that's doing what one mate racing did back in the late 80s and early 90s in the UK. And although Dave Loudon never went on to race at a higher level, people like Patrick Watts did or Steve Soper, etc., became very successful. And later a guy called Rob Huff, who's still around.
Yeah, a lot of touring car racing.
Yep. Yeah. And that's why I'm such an admirer of the 86 thing here.
We've already seen it's got runs on the board. Will Brown came from there. Cameron Hill came from there. There's been a bunch of
Brock Feeney.
Coming there. I hadn't quite got up to him, but you know what I mean. Yep. And there's some young kids in there right now who knows where they might be in the next couple of years. And
absolutely,
they've got. I mean, we've got a really good one make history here, but the choice of cars over the journey is always a bit debatable. I mean, yes. Scafie raced Lasers back in the day. There are none of those cars remaining because I've seen the vision. They were pretty much all crushed and crashed. There was an Alpha Sud series for a time. There was a Triumph TR7 series, a Nissan Pulsar series. We've had a bit of everything over the journey, but probably just means that there was lots of wrecked cars and professional drivers trying to win the prize money or the car that was on offer to sell it off and pocket the cash and move on to the next one along the way. But where did you and Derek Warwick come together or meet, and how did that all start?
We met in the 80s through a mutual friend, and I started to, because I was traveling so much, I'd often be somewhere that it wasn't that hard then to go to a Grand Prix,
just work it out nicely.
And Derek would find himself going to Grand Prix outside Europe by himself a lot of the time. So he had no issue having somebody come along, apart from, you know, I think it was Suzuka, where we actually had to share a hotel room at the Suzuka circuit, because there aren't very many rooms in the lodge at the Suzuka circuit. And he ended up putting his earplugs in, something to do with snoring, and pushed them in so far he had to get Dr. Watkins to take them out the next day with tweezers. Couldn't get them out.
Was your snoring that bad?
Apparently.
Oh, wow. That's never been really bad.
I never
heard. You didn't hear a thing.
No. I was happy.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
So the park lane, I remember the Toyota Carinas in the early 90s. I think one of those cars ended up out here that Greg Murphy actually raced for a time. It's been restored to its Park Lane James K green and white any livery, which that's a bit of a flashback. But so we do a bit of British touring cars. BTCC is really lifting off the back of the 2-litre super touring thing. The manufacturers are throwing cash like crazy. How does 888 come to be and end up with the Vauxhall gig? Because am I right in what I remember that you were trying to grab a – was the Honda deal on the table there at the time as well?
I'd been running the Group N Hondas. They'd been actually been run out of Derek Warwick's dealership.
Because he had a Honda dealership, didn't he?
Yeah, he had several, but there was one in Southampton at the time. They were run out of there. But basically, I was responsible for the funding of them, and either it was, you know, it was part lane sponsorship or it was other people that I found. And I was just, yeah, driving, having fun, etc. Then James Kay was developing as a driver, and I helped him and we bought a Carina and ran it for James, then out of part lane premises. But it was very, it was very much an amateur privateer outfit, and I wasn't going to get any more involved unless it was going to be on a proper professional basis. And then I was at the first Grand Prix in Melbourne in beginning of '96, sitting in the back of the, what would it have been, the Jordan garage with Martin Brundle. Was he driving with Jordan or Ligier?
He was, because he barrel rolled straight down turn 3 that year.
Correct, yeah. He did, absolutely right. Mm. So, yeah, sitting on I think we were sitting on upturned milk crates, to be honest, or something similar, with Jonathan Palmer, Martin and myself, and they both said to me, what are you going to do with Derek? Because Derek was a bit of a loose end. He'd driven touring cars with ProDrive.
Which was the Alphas, wasn't it?
Alpha in 95, et cetera. And, yeah, they both said, well, you know, British touring cars going on, you blokes should be doing something. And anyway, I went back and spoke to Derek and said, yeah, we should start thinking about whether there's something we can put together, because the championship's on a roll. I was good friends with Ian Harrison, who was working at Williams, and I'd known him since, you know, he worked for a time at ProDrive in the early 90s. I'd known him since then. So he was in British touring cars at that point before he went to Willys. Anyway, we said, okay, well, the Honda deal's on the table apparently for looking for a new home for the following year. Shall we go after it? Derek being a Honda dealer, blah, blah, blah. So we did. We tried to put a proposition together and, you know, we'd do this, we'd do that, we'd factory here, team of people. Anyway, Honda. Honda decided to go with ProDrive, but the guy at General Motors Vauxhall in the UK rang up and said, "I gather you're putting something together, and could we talk to you about it?" So we did, and we did a deal very quickly to then become the official team for GM Vauxhall, and we had to put it all together pretty quickly. Get up and running, build cars for 1997, etc. It was a hard year because in those days, the FIA had a homologation system for the aero packs on those cars, which had to be submitted by February the 15th each year, and then you couldn't change it. And the aero kit that we were using, they decided we had to use the Opel one. And Opel being the sister company in Germany of Vauxhall. And it was useless.
Oh, I thought you were going to say shithouse. You can't swear on this podcast. By the way, you didn't have to clean that up. It's okay.
It didn't work at all. It had been developed in a wind tunnel in Germany, which was later torn down.
It was so good.
Yeah. It was abysmal. And so we put it right in 98 and started to win races, but 97 was hard work. And actually, when we came to Bathurst at the end of 97, we got permission to run the 96 aero kit.
Because it wasn't a championship race. So it was kind of this free-for-all, wasn't it? Didn't help Brock, though. He went and damaged your car.
Correct.
Can you give our listeners a bit of a scope? Because we Super Touring and the British Championship of that period is so celebrated today, and we know why it sort of didn't carry on, because it just blew too high through the roof. But how luxurious was it? How much money was floating around? How big were these manufacturers going at the time? Can you sort of quantify that for our listeners who probably just know it from seeing the highlights on TV? But it was big ticket stuff back then.
At the high point in the mid-90s, and I can't remember if it was 95 or thereabout, there were 9 separate manufacturers stroke importers, official importers involved in the championship, and throwing money at it. And one of the things about motorsport is when you've got 9 manufacturers involved in a series, they can't all win. And so there's going to be 8 pissed off on a Monday morning. And now the most I believe that you can expect to look after in a long-term proposition in a motorsport series is somewhere around 3 or 4. So they've all got a chance to share the limelight. So that was the high point, and the spending was increasing rapidly. And it was even in 98, you could see that it wasn't going to last forever, because the everything from the driver fees, the cost of the cars, the interpretation of the rule book was changing so fast, it was going to be ultimately unsustainable. And the rule book was an FIA rule book, and it essentially hadn't changed since they'd adopted a set of British rules that had been written in the UK at the beginning of the decade. They adopted those as what was called Class 2 and then called Super Touring. DTM was Class 1. That exploded as well, or imploded. And Super 2 was Class 2. And the rule book was essentially the same, just plus an aero kit, which came in for 95, I think it was. But essentially the rules were the same, but the cars morphed from sort of Group N plus to Group C minus, as it were, pretty quickly, which was crazy. So, no, the money was outrageous. In the final year of Super Touring, the year 2000, we ran 3 cars as 888 in the UK, and we had a budget which would have equated at the time to at the exchange rate at the time to $30 million Australian dollars. And ours was the smallest.
And that's not even the biggest.
Yeah, it was the smallest.
And how much, like from a percentage point of view, how much is the manufacturer tipping? They're tipping in the lion's share, or
all of it?
All of it. You didn't. It wasn't a case of
no. We didn't.
You'd have to
go
and find a few other things to put some other stickers on here. That is everything. Go for it. Do what you got to do.
We didn't need a sales department or a marketing department at all.
No,
that was the one big saving.
Yeah,
because the manufacturer came to you, gave you the money, and
off you go.
And you went off. And that's what. Yeah, that was the definition of a factory team.
Mm, very factory team. Mm. Yeah, very. We just touched on it before. So it's 25 years this year since 888 went to Bathurst. We were at a really interesting
97.
Mm. Yeah. So we were in a really interesting state here where we had two Bathursts going. We had a – depends which side you're on and which part of history you like to tell, but the V8s had up and left the traditional race. They took some of their tradition and created their own one. Channel 10 showed that one. Channel 7 stuck with what it had. It looked to Tokyo to fill the field, so some cars, including yours, came out to run against the local cars in the V8s race 2 weeks later. Peter Brock comes to drive for 888, our hero driving with the overseas GM team. Do you remember how that all came together? Obviously, we know about the rollover, what happened in the race and all that sort of stuff,
yeah.
But how that all played out?
I mean, Alan Gow came to who was running Tokyo in the UK and had an interest in the Australian side of it as well with Terry Morris and Peter Adton and co. Alan Gow came to us as teams in the UK and said, look, there's an opportunity. Channel 7 are going to pay for a grid to be put together. This is the deal. Air freight your cars out there, sea freight them back. Do you want to come and play? And so we all said, how much money?
Yeah. Yeah. First question, how much money? Yeah.
It was. And so, and he said, you've got X and plus this, this, and this. And so, yeah. Said, okay. Well, what freedoms have we got around that and everything? Yeah. You can go and get sponsors as well or this or that. So we said, yeah, we're coming. And not only because it was a chance to earn some money, but it was also a chance to then have our cars shipped to South Africa on the way back and go testing at Kyalami over the
which
northern
was
winter.
A common thing for the British teams at the time to go and test.
Not that common.
No? Well, no. I seem to remember a lot of them over
several
there.
Of us did. Yeah. But, okay. Yeah.
The ones that had all the money, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so actually worked for a couple of points of view. The Gow came and said, we've got a sponsor for one of your cars, which was effectively Australian Grand Prix Corporation, bringing Qantas to the party. And it comes with Peter Brock. And so we said, oh, fair enough. He knows his way around the track. So they put that together as having a recent Formula One star in the car in Derek, plus Brocky. And the other car, we could then we put John Cleland and James Kahan in the other car with some other money. And so it made sense economically to us, a lot of sense.
Was it the first time you'd gone to Bathurst, the first time you'd actually?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then back in 98, where 98 was commercially much better because we got paid twice. Because Vauxhall were quite keen to have us there because the footage would be shown back in the UK, and Holden were quite keen to have a car there, as you know, that was with Russell Ingall and Greg Murphy. Channel 7 were almost desperate to have us there. There weren't as many people put their hand up the second year as the first year. They were very keen that we were there. So I think we got paid two or three times to do the same thing.
Secret of business, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a good win.
Well, you did have to cover off one car, though, because Russell did end up headlong into a fence over the top of the hill there at one point.
He did.
I think that was a junker, wasn't it? That one was a write-off.
No.
They rebuilt that one.
No, that I believe that car went on to race in Sweden.
Oh, well, the Swedes will do anything, won't they?
Polished out in the centre.
Just buffed out, no problem, no problem. Yeah. What did Brock say when he went and rolled one of your cars in practice at the chase? I think he was one of the first days of practice and he tipped it over in the gravel
track.
First
lap of practice.
First lap out.
I think so. And it, cold rear tyres. I don't know, he had a cup of tea.
Oh, that's what it was. Needed herbal tea. That would have fixed it.
Yeah.
Oh. The second that you got there and you'd seen on TV, you knew about Bathurst, and I know how special and important it's been to you for Triple Eight in trying to win that race, and the team's obviously won it 8 times now, but was that where the love of Bathurst was really born, the minute that you arrived with those Vauxhalls and become – obviously you went away and you were away for a couple of years before the V8 thing happened, but Bathurst gets into your blood, it gets into you, and it becomes the passion. Is that where it really kicked in?
No, my feeling of connection with Bathurst came about through a Wheels magazine that I referred to earlier, but also watching packages of the Bathurst 1000 in the 80s that were rebroadcast the same day because, you know, time difference and everything, and watching things like the Jaguars driving around there in the mid-80s. And to be honest, with the when we went there with the 2-litre cars, I thought, all this pit area is a shithole.
Which was the old one before they knocked it over, yeah.
And there's bugger all people here. It was underwhelming, to be honest. Apart from the setting, it was... The whole experience was underwhelming, and it wasn't until I went to the first time, 2003, went as 888 Australia to Bathurst with a proper crowd, the proper grid, that I really appreciated what Bathurst was all about and the campsites and everything. Even then, I mean, the pits were absolutely appalling. From a working environment, from an OH&S point of view, and even if we weren't that interested then in OH&S, we were a bit.
It was a pain in the ass to just wheel the cars out through the people and
shocking.
Back out of the pit lane and back to the garages. And
the one thing it was, though, was atmospheric.
Mm.
So... and I still rate one of the best things that Tony Cochran ever did for Motorsport in Australia was putting together the money to have that pit complex built and the paddock put into its current form in 2004 at Bathurst. So luckily I only had to endure 1 year.
You did. You got your timing right.
yeah, of the old paddock, because the new one is was at that time and still is today world class.
Yeah, because you didn't really get the proper Bathurst experience when you came those first couple of times, because to the Heartland fan, if you ask them who won Bathurst in 97, it's Perkins and Ingle, not the BMWs, because it wasn't their race. It was the traditional broadcaster, traditional date, but if you took the cars that raced regularly in the main championship with the local heroes away from that, it wasn't the same. So you kind of got a Diet Coke level Bathurst, not a full sugar version, really, and that's why it didn't feel the same.
Yeah, totally. Mm. I mean, it wasn't even Diet Coke. It was sparkling water.
Zero.
It was nothing. It just didn't feel that special.
No. So we talked about Super Touring, that it goes through the roof, it dies. Of course, it dies here because it dies there, because the one here lived off what happened there.
Mm.
When did you – was it that change of the rules to the more standard type of cars for the championship in Britain to continue that made you look here? Was there any other places that you could have gone that had grabbed your attention as a place to maybe take up a challenge or get involved, or was it always going to be to have a look at here?
Yeah, I mean, it was a number of things. You know, I was divorced. I'd had a massive – court case against the British government for them acting outside EU law, and which they settled in my favor out of court. But also, when they paid me the money, they also, one department, the Department of Transport, which was a guilty party, rang up the Treasury and said, we've just given this company a load of money, so you might want to see how much tax they're paying next year. So
this was to do with business world, not motorsport world.
Yeah, yep. And it totally do with the car business, and the which had, through the 90s, we were incredibly successful. I became a resident of Gibraltar, which it's, to be honest, not a very exciting place to be. I needed a change of life as well. I was bored. I sort of, bought about three houses in quick succession and moved three times in the UK as well. I wasn't settled. I needed a new challenge. The BTCC had ceased to be a challenge by 2003. To be honest, the cars were what they needed to be for the time. Don't get me wrong. They were absolutely fit for purpose at the time. Much simpler. Too easy to drive, really. And didn't provide the same spectacle. The championship itself was not particularly healthy because it's very involved, but all to do with a company called Interpublic, I think it was, that ended up owning it for a while and doing a shonky deal around the British Grand Prix as well, which was meant to go to Donington or Brands Hatch and everything.
There was a whole pile of stuff.
Of stuff that was just ugly. Anyway, I've been to Australia many times, but I'd also I came 2001 to the Gold Coast, came back in 2002, went and spoke to Cochrane about it. What's the commercial makeup here? And I could see there was commercial opportunity as well as the cars being interesting. Even as being a spectator in Adelaide. In the late 80s, early 90s, we all used to watch the Australian whatever touring cars were at the time and enjoy it, because despite all the hassles over Group A and then changing to V8s, they were still spectacular, whatever they were, and faster than what we had in the UK. Even the Group A cars were faster because they were using, fuel that we couldn't dream of in Europe, and all the better for it. But I remember it at when Derek was driving for Lotus in 1990, and just standing on the pit wall with a stopwatch and timing Jim Richards and Mark Scaife coming round the corner in the Skylines and flooring it up to where the Lotus pit was and comparing it with the same time in the Formula One car, Lotus. And they were easy quicker every time. Now,
really?
Even though they were heavy, they were four-wheel drive, et cetera, had similar horsepower, and just powering out of, when they came into your eyes view at the apex of the corner and powering out, it was funny. We'd stand there and laugh. Watching, I think, Wayne Gardner racing at HRT car there as well,
right.
At one stage.
93, yep.
Yeah, which, because we all knew Wayne Gardner's name, we'd sort of stand there and watch. I was fascinated by it, but I was fascinated by the commercial opportunities.
So when you 2000, I mean, history, we know the history. You bought John Briggs's team to create your 888 in Australia, but there was a lot of stuff going on at the time from a Holden perspective with Walkinshaw's collapse overseas, HRT, Kmart. So you were in the market for that, but were you offered Kmart in the end, and you didn't want it because you wanted the main team? Is that the basic premise of it all?
Yeah, I mean, when the Walkinshaw thing happened in early 2003, the guy who was running GM Vauxhall in the UK was a guy called Kevin Whale, who had been a long-time Holden person. He was Australian. He'd gone from Australia to Singapore, I think it was, to the international division, then on to the UK. He was a massive supporter of AAA in the UK. I said to him, can you put in a word with us with Holden? Because Holden had taken over the Walkinshaw cars but couldn't keep them because the rules of TIGA rules, a manufacturer or an importer couldn't own a team. So they had to divest themselves of it. Anyway, and Kevin Whale, he tried and drew a blank because too many local interests decided what they were going to do. But then, we were offered the what was then the Kmart team. And that ended up with the Kellys. But, I was offered that and I said no.
We know what you did do. You ended up on the other side of the divide for the next 7 years in terms of Better Electrical and Vodafone and Falcons. And we're going to next year, it'll be the 20th anniversary of Triple Eight Australia, which is scary that it's flown so fast. September 03, if I remember rightly, Paul Radisich and Rickard Rydell, who came out to drive the Enduros that year.
That's right.
And Dean Cantor, who was a full-timer, and Matthew White actually drove with him. Not the TV Matthew White, the Super 2 team owner, who's a long-time driver, team owner. What did you really expect you were going to do? I mean, you could not have predicted all of this. You would have hoped for what's happened. But what was the initial expectation for the first couple of years at the least? Because there's no way you could have planned all this. No way. I mean, you're good, but seriously, like, you could not have ended up with the thought that there'd be 230-plus wins, championships to boot, Bathurst wins, you know, all the stats that keep me interested in all that stuff. But you couldn't have predicted all that. So what was the initial short-term goal plan from 03 and getting into it?
Let's give it 3 years and see where we are. So by the end of 06, are we making a fist of it or not? And has this got potential? But it meant being in boots and all, especially when I really understood that at Briggs's, there was a small core of very good people, and as you know, some around today. But there was no management to speak of. And that meant then getting, rolling up my sleeves and getting stuck into it completely. And then trying to build the team from that. I was very fortunate that I had my first choice of technical support in terms of Ludo Lacroix wanting to come and get involved as well. There was a backup plan as well, but Ludo was far and away the first choice.
Who was your backup plan?
He's still working today.
All right, we'll wait till he's not. We can tell that story another day. Okay, that's for part two of Rolling Down the Track. Yeah.
But, yeah, there was a and Ludo came and then we had to learn, hands-on. I'd known Campbell Little for 10 years or so, basically since we'd sold that Carina you referred to earlier to a guy called
Bruce Miles in New Zealand.
Christchurch.
Yep.
Yeah. So Campbell came to work for us, which was helpful in terms of understanding the local topography, championship and everything. So, yeah, we got stuck in and then basically trying to work out first and foremost what the commercial side was going to look like over the next 5 years and planning that, and off the back of that then seeing, okay, well, if we're aspiring to this, it's a sort of chicken and egg. So as long as we can show ourselves in a reasonable light, you know, and a, without being derogatory, a better light than the Briggs outfit had, then we've got half a chance of making this stack up.
Everyone will obviously wind back and look to Craig coming to Triple Eight for 05. Huge thing for your team. And it, I guess probably from the point of view, and I know you've talked about this before and I've read it and seen in other interviews, but when you had, you know, he was a known entity. He'd been a champion. He was the people's champ. He still is the people's champ. If you were doing good enough in building cars and providing equipment, if it was winning, or if it wasn't winning and Craig Lowndes is driving it, you know that you've got a guy that can win races and your car's not quite there. So how – that's a, he's the crucial element to the next phase of that. But that was the big ticket thing, not just because he was a name, not just because he was a smiley face and all the stuff that he is, but he would not just give you legitimacy. He would also let you understand where our gear's at because we know he's good. That was that was a basic premise of that too, not just the fact that he was clearly very good as well.
Yeah, I mean, it, Craig, if you like, as far as the local scene was concerned, there was Marcus Ambrose and there was Craig Lowndes, and Craig hadn't been able to show his true pace really since he walked away from the HRT scene. And he was frustrated by that. He was looking for a solution to that. And one thing that I think, as I've always been, is a good salesman. And Campbell Little helped me at the time as well with Craig. But, you know, sold him the dream at a time when he was ready to be sold the dream because he wasn't happy where he was. So, you know, as Garth Tander will tell you, I spoke to him as well. I spoke to Murph. But the aim, if I could get Craig, was to, yeah, was to get Craig. And because Marcus wasn't about to leave Stones at that time.
Did you ask him to?
I spoke to him, but only to know what his contractual arrangements were. But Craig was the one who could give us on track and off track credibility.
What was the process of selling him? How did you sell it to him? What did you sell to him that got him over the line, and how'd you go about it?
Look, I went and sat with him, Campbell and I, at his house in Kilcoy at that time, and sat with him and look. Despite what it sometimes looked like in 2004, we do know what we're doing. And plus, I've done a deal with Stones to use their engines in 2005. Every race that goes by now, yeah, we're learning more and more. And we know how to do it. We know how to win races. And, yeah, at that stage... between Ludo and I, we'd won an awful lot of races, not in Australia, but elsewhere. So, and Craig wanted to be convinced. That was the great thing. Yeah, he wanted an excuse to leave where he was. The only real opposition to it really was the guy who ran Ford at the time, a guy called Tom Gorman. Why are you going up there? We formed this super team down here. Of Ford Performance Racing, etc., with ProDrive. Why do you want to go up there? But Craig wanted to be in Queensland as well.
Mm.
And luckily for us, he bought the dream.
And that's where we're going to leave part one of my chat with Roland Dane. We have to leave a little bit in the bank for next week. And there's not a little bit in the bank. There is a lot in the bank to talk about next week. We talk about Triple H's breakthrough win, the Stone Brothers engine deal that got them going, how their success changed some of the rules of the Bathurst 1000. We talk about the 2006 Bathurst race and the winning car. We talk about some of the great years at Bathurst where the team won the race, some of the years where they contended but didn't win. There's always a story of Triple Eight and Bathurst. We also talk about his car collection and
Jason Plato as well. He tackles the National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions. It's a very big part two of my podcast chat with Roland Dane. It comes up next week on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco. Don't forget, every Tuesday, Castrol Motorsport News podcast with Andrew Van Leeuwen and Stefan Bartholomaeus, the boys, with the latest of news and insight into Australian and world motorsport. If you don't subscribe to it, you really should, so the notification will come up on your device, whether it's your mobile or your laptop, wherever it might be, whenever there is a new episode published. They're normally about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock every Tuesday afternoon. It's the perfect pod for you to drive home to or to commute home from work or have it on around the house, whatever the case may be, at that time of day for you to get your latest fix of Castrol Motorsport News. Right, that's it. We're done. Part one of Roland Dane is in the books. Part two comes at you next Wednesday. If you're listening to this down the track and you've just listened to this episode, you can just scroll ahead and listen to part two. But if you're listening to it at the time we've published it, you're going to have to wait a week. But I'm sure it is worth the wait. There's plenty of great chat topics in among that one. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Really appreciate the support. We'll chat to you next week with another episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco.